Accession number 19638, reel 5.
Mr. Charles Jordan, reel 5.
So, did your day begin very early?
I think it was around about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we arrived back in the prisoner war camp around about 5, half past 5. When we arrived, we were searched by the guard, and numbers were counted. The search was always done in a certain way, which we had noted, and they enabled us to smuggle little loot bags of sugar and sometimes rice into the camp without being caught. The method we used, we had little white cloth bags that we put on our left arm under the Japanese fatigue dress that we wore to and from camp, to and from the workplace. The guard always searched in one way, by running their hands down your back, down the front and down your legs, then going to the right arm. And as they come to the left arm, we carried a sort of homemade haversack with a flap over it. And when they came to do the right arm, we just reached round and pulled the bag and opened the flap over the to open it and show them there was nothing in the bag. And they used to say, the Japanese word was yoroshi, which is all right. And they go on to the next person. This went on for several months, and we were never caught. Until one day, one of the party's loot bag split, and there was sugar on the road, and the whole party got then punished. Punishment was lining in front of the guard room. The guard commander hit you around the head and the body with his sword in its scabbard. You stood there, you had to take it. And you stood there for a matter of about 6 hours. And each time the sentry went past, he'd give you a little thud. But by this time, we had sort of psychoanalyzed them, and we knew that if we flinched or tried to get away from the blow, they would beat you even more. So although it was a very painful process, each time we got struck, we used to sort of smile at them. And funny enough, it did the trick. They used to go on, I don't know, because they thought they'd lost face if they carried on. And that's how we got, and obviously it happened on several occasions in the camp.
Did that put a stop to bringing any secrets? No,
it meant that we had to find another hiding place. We had actually three places we used all the time as a prisoner of war. The second one was in the Chinese uniform cap they had. And what we did, we split the lining in that and put the loot bag in that and wore it on our heads. And we got away with that for ages and I couldn't tell you the length of time. The unfortunate part about it was when you arrived back at camp, you had to, they number you off in Japanese, and then you had to salute. You not only saluted the guard, but you faced the Emperor's palace and took off your hat and bowed. So you can imagine hands going up very gingerly, taking off their hats. That went on for quite a long time. Same thing happened as the bag on the arm. So one day it split, we got the same treatment. So we had to derive another hiding place. We all issued with Japanese footwear, and it was a rubber shoe, a canvas top rubber shoe, with the toe separate from the toe cap. So the toe was an individual covering, you know. Very peculiar things. Of course, we worked in bare feet all the time when we were working. And we then made small loop bags which we placed in our footwear. I always remember it because by the time we returned to camp and got back into our own sort of bed spaces and sort of took out our loot bag, it was like taking out a plank of wood. It was solid sugar, you know. But there was only sugar we could do that. You couldn't do it with rice or beans. You wouldn't be able to walk properly. And that was our last. We never got discovered in that. That was our last hiding place.
Jerry.
But this food was not for ourselves. It was for no individual, I think the only way you could describe it, no individual had personal belongings. Everything you had was shared with your companions, and the comradeship was wonderful, really was.
And there was no one who strayed from that tenet?
In all the time I was there, not one person stole or had an argument with another person. We're all in the same boat. We're all sort of semi-starved, I assume you could call it. But there was never any stealing or pilfering in all the time I was in that prisoner of war camp, which I think says a lot for the British soldier.
Would you describe the conditions in your living quarters at the prisoner of war camp?
Well, the only way you can describe it really is long sort of bungalow-type buildings with just the one entrance, with a corridor, with a path running the full length from the door to the end of the building. On either side there was platforms built. These were lined with rush matting. And that was our bed base. We sat head to foot. You just had your body width, which you could say was your own, really. And funny enough, we had no squabbles and no problems with that at all. We couldn't do anything about it anyhow, so we had to take it.
What were the sanitary conditions like?
They had toilets in the camp, but not in the huts. They were sort of a separate building. You had to govern yourself because you weren't able to go to the toilet in the middle of the night. Any movement, there was would create a bit of a panic amongst the Japanese. So you were controlled by that, and I don't think I can recall anybody having any problem with it.
Were there plenty of guards posted around at night?
You had the guard in the guard room, which is the entrance of the camp, and whoever's the guard commander of that guard, he would call in each hut and look around at. You never knew. There wasn't any time with him. You never know when he was going to come round. And anyway, in any case, I mean, after working all day, most of us were, how can I put it, just so tired you just slept. And that was our life, I mean, sleep, eat a little, and work hard.
Did you tend to have regular guards?
We had the senior NCO. He was what I would assume in the British rank would be a colour sergeant or a sergeant major. He was always there. The guard commanders were usually, I suppose, the equivalent of a lance sergeant or a corporal in British ranks. The guard commander with five other ranks. But the colour sergeant was an absolute swine. He was always in charge of the guard, and he'd make spot checks, and whenever he came into the, especially if he was worse for drink, he'd come in and have a spot count, which he always got wrong because of the state he was in. And because he got wrong, he used to fly in a rage, and the poor unfortunate person that was standing closest to him, in other words, prisoner, got really battered. He'd do what they all do. He always wore a sword in a scabbard, and a very, very heavy sword. And he beat you around the head and the body until he was satisfied. And then he'd go away. On one occasion, I know it happened several times in other huts, but in our hut, he came on. We had to number off hut by hut. On this occasion, he was with the guard commander, and he had us numbering off. And one unfortunate prisoner of war was very sick, and he didn't answer. He was suffering from dysentery, I believe, or malnutrition. I don't know what it was, but he was very, very, very ill. And because he never answered, I can't call him anything else, but a sadist, a swine, whatever, had the guard carry him out, and in the centre of the prison courtyard, we had a big, huge water tower, and that man, he had the guard carry him to the tower and throw him into the water, and obviously he died. That was, I think, from other people, speaking to other people, it happened on several occasions, but it did him now on one occasion. But he was an absolute sadist.
So the cause of death would have been drowning, would it?
Yes, yes. And beating. I mean, the chap was beaten unconscious, really. And unfortunately, you had to stand and take it. You couldn't do anything about it. And apparently there was no comeback. That prisoner of war was just written off, apparently, by the guard commander, the camp commandant, rather. I never heard that he'd ever been disciplined for his attitude. We had very little contact with the actual camp commandant. The only officer, Japanese officer, we had contact with was the interpreter, who was a lieutenant, and his nickname was Lieutenant Yuno, because he started every sentence in English with Yuno, Yuno. He was obviously called Lieutenant Yuno, but he was not as sadistic as the others. In fact, we rather ridiculed him, you know.
Did you have nicknames for most of them among yourselves?
For the Japanese? Yeah. It was other than the colour sergeant and the lieutenant. The guard was frequently changed. You saw new faces. Wasn't able to give any derogatory nicknames to any of them. You got to know, for a period of time, certain individuals that marched you to and from camp, to and from the workplace, I should say.
How far did you have to march to the workplace?
Well, my recollection, I should say around about 2 miles. And we used to march through the town. Well, I say march, we shambled really, with the guard in front and the guard behind. But the senior on our work party, anyhow, because I worked at a firm called Kanna Motors, which is one of the big industrialist firm, and the senior man of each party, in our case, was a leading seaman, Royal Navy, and we used to see the companies or platoons of troops marching, Japanese troops marching in the town, and saw the general public sort of standing, watching them and cheering them. And we used to think, well, they were absolute shambles, you know. And it's one little victory we had, I suppose. We had this leading hand says, look at that shambles, let's show them how to march. And from that day onwards, we marched all in step and kept as straight as possible. Sort of real military fashion. And the general public used to watch us rather than their own troops. So we scored a minor victory there.
Did they have smart uniforms like the Germans?
No. There was no. It was sort of cotton wear. Rather a drab green colour, I can't recall the actual colouring, but it's green and they're very light. Of course, because that's what we wore. We wore exactly the same because we had no clothing after the sinking. And maybe it's a good thing because we were able to adapt to the clothing and for our carrying evolution, things like that. It seemed to be as if everybody read each other's minds. The beating up, from the very start, we never showed fear. We never cringed.
Because that's
and
their
that
way,
was right
isn't it?
Through the camp. I mean, it wasn't just one set of individuals. Right through the camp, we seem to read the Japanese mind. They have a very peculiar attitude. If you cringe, they punish you even more. But, well, they take advantage of it and really do beat you up. If you just smile at them or sort of turn their cheek, it seemed to work to your advantage. You didn't get a dozen blows, you got about a couple, and they move on to the next person. And consequently, he'd do the same. And it went right. I mean, we had a party of 12, and you all got the same punishment. But if one individual had cringed or flinched, I'm afraid he would be the scapegoat for the rest of the party. So nobody flinched or cringed. Although, personally, I think you wanted to, but you didn't.
If you were able to talk in the evening, I mean, if you felt up to talking, was there a fellowship? Was there a very good morale?
The morale was wonderful amongst our own people. But, to be quite frank, as regards conversation between one another, you really had nothing to converse about. We got no news from home. We weren't in contact with other camps. Consequently, there were no rumours that you could talk about or anything like that. I think one just lived from day to day. You supported one another, and that's all you could do. You didn't have a sing-song or anything like that. I mean, there was no entertainment amongst ourselves. I think we were with our with our style of living in the prisoner war camp, you were so tired after work parties and you had to even meal, you just were what they call in the army flaked out, and it became routine. Everything was routine right through that time.
Were you aware of any boredom with it all?
Be quite honest, I don't think you could be bored. I mean, there was nothing to be bored with in that respect. You just lived from day to day. If there had been sort of scope for being bored, I think there might have been problems. Well, that's my own personal opinion.
I have one friend who was in a prisoner of war camp of the Japanese and felt he wanted to give up at one stage because his health became very poor. Did you at any time feel like that?
No. It was up to the individual on how he sort of met the circumstances that we had to endure. Excuse me. And I can honestly say I don't know of anybody that had just given up hope. Not in all the time I was in that camp. Obviously we had the deaths in the camp from malnutrition and dysentery, but there was never any mourning. It was just sort of John Jones is gone or Jack Jones is gone, and that was just one less. But so there was no, we never had any funeral parties anybody who died, I think they were put in an incinerator. I don't know whether the Japs spread the ashes or anything like that, I just don't know. It was just that you were there 1 minute, he was there 1 minute, and the next day he was gone. You didn't sort of dwell on the circumstances at all.
If anyone did become very ill, did they have any medication administered or anything
no,
like that?
There was no medication. I don't recall ever seeing a Japanese medical officer enter that camp in the near enough 4 years. If you were sick and were not fit to work, you were put in an isolated hut. It was left to you whether you recovered or not. Fortunately, I never had to endure that. But if you didn't go out to work, you were on half rations, which is starvation. And part of the reason why we smuggled what little we could into the camp was not for our own use, but it was mainly for those unfortunates who were sick at that time. If you went into that, the only time you sort of greeted anybody was when they come out of what we call the sick bay. In other words, they survived it and they were able to continue the day's routines. If you didn't come out of the sick bay, you knew there was only one thing, eventual incineration. And incidentally, we had to smuggle that extra food into those individuals in the camp, into the other hut, which was quite a problem at times. I never took part in the smuggling part, but any extras I was brought back was put on in the sort of central pool of the hut you was in. The senior in the hut, or our spokesman, I suppose you could call it, would attend to the disposal of that.
Was water severely rationed as well?
In the camp, you had a normal drink of water. You had water containers in the hut, but the diet of rice tends to go to water.
I think you mentioned earlier that it was flaked rice.
Well, in other words, it cooked so that you could more or less pick up individual. It was steamed. It wasn't boiled. It was a steam rice. You see it on the documentaries in India where they can pick up a handful of rice. It wasn't soggy, ever soggy. I think they were cooked in huge steamed in huge great urns, and each hut was given the equivalent of what was required.
You mentioned feeling hungry. Did you personally feel very hungry?
You never really thought, you didn't really. You never thought about hunger. You ate what you could, when you could. Especially on the work parties, working on sugar, you would eat handfuls of sugar each time you went to the warehouse. It was all types of sugar, demerara, caster sugar, granulated sugar. I think it was mostly loot from Philippines and places like that, or Burma. We'd eat that, and were eating sugar in that amount, what goodness you derive from that mouthful of sugar was used up by the time you carried one sack of sugar to the railway truck or wherever you were carrying it to. In other words, sugar gave you instant energy, but